Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the Leo P. Flynn Gallery in the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls. And this summer, we feature the Brown Bag Book Club on In the Moment. We're bringing in some of the top authors in the region for in-depth conversations. You're invited to join us Mondays at noon in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios throughout the summer. Next week, we feature South Dakota One Book author Kent Nerburn. We'll talk about his creative manifesto, Dancing with the Gods. But this week, we welcome poets laureate Leanne Rohrpaugh and Christine Stewart. Leanne Rohrpaugh has been serving as state poet laureate for 4 years, and her term ends on July 1st. And Christine Stewart is taking the helm as the new state poet laureate. So, Leanne, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Christine, thanks, and welcome back to both of you.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I want to start with the position itself, because David Allen Evans, if you're from South Dakota, you probably remember that for 12 years this was his role, and then he decided it was time to make way for some other poets, and so now it's a four-year appointment from the governor of South Dakota. So, Leanne, when you're the first person to really take over for David Allen Evans, and that brought with it some of, opportunities and challenges. How did you look at that opportunity at the time moving forward? And then we'll talk about if it turned out as you expected it to.
Well, I was really excited by the whole idea of the four-year term, because I think it's going to be an opportunity to showcase poetry in South Dakota and all of our many very talented poets. So that was an exciting turn of events for me. And then I conceptualized it as really an opportunity to be an ambassador for poetry in state. So it's been a great 4 years. I've been traveling, giving readings, doing workshops, doing a lot of driving, and it's just been it's been really wonderful. Yeah.
And I took a workshop with you at the South Dakota Festival of Books in Deadwood, and I knew it was going to be good when I signed up, but I had no idea how much I could learn in such a short period of time. So it is a powerful thing to have someone come, even if you're coming for a reading or a speaking or a workshop, and then move on. Do you find that too, that, you know, even though you teach in a university level and you get students, you know, who are with you for years maybe, that you can make a big impact on a writer in a short period of time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a different kind of art. You know, when you're teaching over the course of the semester, it's a different pacing. But when you're doing sort of a one-off workshop, you have that very concentrated space, which I think brings a kind of specialness or intensity to the time. And, you know, this is something that Christine can also probably attest to. When you're visiting, there's a little bit more sparkle, I think, because, you know, I can say things to my students during the course of the semester repeatedly, but if I have a visiting poet come and say the same things, suddenly they're more exciting or authoritative, I suppose.
And Christine, you've been across the state to a certain extent, maybe not as much as you're about to be in this role, but you've been a big fixture at book festivals over the years. Tell me a little bit about that notion of the impact that even you maybe saw Lee have over the past 4 years, and the impact that this position can have throughout the region.
Well, I remember my first meeting with Lee, which was in Nebraska at a reading. So it was at one of those small, you know, kind of intimate poetry readings. And that was the first time we'd ever met. And I was overwhelmed by her generosity and the sonics, the music of her writing, and just that one reading with some questions and answers just kind of pushed me to a new level in my own thinking about poetry. And I was a graduate student at the time in Nebraska, and so those two things, I had no idea I would get a job here in South Dakota at the time. So, but that just set a groundwork for what those moments could be for me. And so I really feel lucky to continue to learn from her and to kind of share those kinds of moments with other students in South Dakota and other writers across the state. There's something really distilled, just like a good poem. There's something that can be really distilled in those 1 or 2 hour workshops or 1 or 2 hour readings that you kind of bring away those one or two things, but they're so distilled, they last for a long time.
Yeah. What did you learn about South Dakota and South Dakotans over the past 4 years that you didn't expect to sort of be revealed to you in this role?
I didn't particularly have expectations because I had been reading, you know, across the state during my time here. I came in 2000, but, you know, what really blew me away was just the level of engagement, how welcoming and generous the audiences were, and how open to poetry and to being willing to ask questions and really kind of think about the work that I was putting in front of them. And so I wouldn't say that I was surprised by that based on my readings or my students, but it was really delightful to experience that.
Do we have in this state a strong poetry tradition? How do you explain, if you go across the country in your role, how do you explain to others, you know, what does the poetry of South Dakota look like?
I think that that's such an interesting question because on the one hand, I think that there's an expectation that South Dakota poetry is always already place-based. And so there's this notion that, you know, South Dakota poetry is always rural, always about kind of place and location, which, you know, a lot of the best poetry from the state very much is. And I think that's, you know, a wonderful tradition. But South Dakota is also complicated in the sense that, you know, we have Sioux Falls or Rapid City, which are more kind of urban environments. We have a very rich culture in terms of we think about the different, you know, ethnicities or, you know, abilities or orientations of people who live in the state. And so there's a lot of diversity there, too. So one of the things I noticed when I work with my students is the idea that sometimes they feel that they don't have anything to write about, you know, and they already do because it's a very rich state, I think, with traditions, but then also very kind of leading edge diversities too.
And on that topic, I've told the story far too many times, and maybe you're tired of hearing it, Christine, but the first time I ever saw you was a poetry reading at Augustana, and Patrick Hicks had brought you in, and you were reading something, and I thought, I didn't know I could write about that. I didn't know that that's, yeah. And I wonder though if that has something to say about the diversity conversation in that at that point in my life I had not heard many women poets. And so most of the poetry I had been exposed to were male poets, and you were writing about a very unique female experience. And so it was not only your poetry, but it was who you brought to the, you know, it was your voice that connected with me and said, oh, I do have something to say because that experience is speaking to me. Do you find that say a little bit more about what Ali was saying about diversity and the different kinds of voices that we have through the state. How do you bring that to your poetry, just your own experiences and who you are?
I bring my own experiences mostly because as sources of inspiration and things to as springboards to jump off up from. That's certain, whether it's someone close to me being ill or loss or my own issues of body and what's happened to me physically or my son's illness. Those sorts of things always demand my attention, so I need to write about them to make meaning from them. That's just kind of the way I do things. And so a lot of times those subjects are taboo or aren't often heard about, but I bring them anyway to the table. And I try to pull on research, and which I define as anything outside of the realm of myself. So whether it's travel or actual, you know, reading research or other writers or other poets to bring in to intersect with those and to complicate my own experience, if you will. So,
and then immediately after I thought, oh, I didn't know you could write about that, I thought, and how in the world do you do that? I wanted to pick apart and find out how you had done it so masterfully. So studying you know, you both have studied poetry for so long and so intently. Do you have a formative experience with poetry, or, you know, when you were young that you thought, not only is this going to be part of my life forever, but this is going to be something that I want to dedicate my own energy to learning how to do? How did you get your start in that regard? Leanne?
I wrote poetry from the time I was very young. My father was a writer, and I went to a university lab school in Laramie, Wyoming, so I was allowed to take college classes early on. So I took my first college class when I was 10, and they were always in English or literature, poetry, and creative writing. So I always had that interest, but, you know, in terms of thinking about a formative moment, and then also the question of permission, I think that, you know, you've been talking about, for me to read poets of other ethnicities, you know, to read Black poets, Native American poets, and particularly in my case, Asian American poets, since I'm half Japanese, to see that reflection on the page, as well as the difference of experience, was so illuminating, and it allowed me to say, well, a poem could look like that, or a poem could come from this sort of voice or this sort of experience, and that permission was so empowering for me.
Christine, formative experiences of poetry.
I remember my mom would recite poems that she'd memorized in high school to me as a kid, just to distract me from probably whatever I was supposed to not be doing. but writing poetry was something that I started to do a lot when my sister passed away when I was 11. So I remember writing on receipts from my mom's purse or napkins when we were planning the funeral, and I would just kind of put them in the casket, and I imagined that they would go with her. You know, so I had all of the, and then I tried to write novels about death, and, you know, I made up characters because I think I was processing what had happened to me through writing. And I chose some poetry, but they're all metaphor. It was all metaphor or fiction because it was too direct to talk about my actual experience. So I chose indirect ways to get there. But then I've been writing, and I wrote a lot of different things ever since, but then I accidentally I signed up in college for two classes, one poetry and one fiction, and I only got into the poetry class, so that's, you know, I started, that kind of paved the way for the rest of it.
Yeah. What was your writing relationship with your father?
It was interesting. He was actually, I think, maybe my first teacher or my first mentor. He shared poems with me, and when I was a kid and I would write poems, I would show them to him, and he would help me. So in that sense, that was a gift. I guess the other side of that blade was that it took me until I was in my mid-20s. I actually went to school and studied piano performance because I always thought that, you know, I couldn't envision myself as being a writer on my own terms or, you know, on my own steam, if you will. And so it took me some time to kind of find a way to come to writing on my own terms and in my own voice and kind of write myself out from underneath his shadow.
Yeah. Christine, as you look at the next 4 years, how do you sort of position yourself to begin?
Well, one of the things that I've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years is editing the South Dakota State Poetry Society's poetry journal, Paskpuddles, which has been being published since 1927. So it's a huge state tradition we have that I don't know if many people know about it. It used to be stapled together and just like mimeographed, right? And before I took it over, it got a facelift. And then when I took it over, it got another, you know, transformation into a really professionally designed journal. But one of the things that I've realized is that more and more people are finding it and writing, and I'm finding writers from across the state in places that I didn't know about, or people writing. And I imagine that a lot of the writing is happening that's not happening in universities, that is happening at homes and, mm-hmm. and, very solo enterprises. So I hope to bring that out more and help people connect. So I've been helping them connect their poems in past puddles, but now as Poet Laureate, I hope to help connect even more. And I will edit a poetry anthology about South Dakota by South Dakotans and use that as a springboard to move poetry conversations forward. So that's my project as I've envisioned it.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is, and maybe you can speak, both of you can speak to this, is what does it mean to be a South Dakotan if, you know, you're not necessarily born and raised here? How can poetry provide an entry into place, as well as poems can be about place and can explore place, but can you come to a place and say, this is the door that's going to open. This is how I'm going to connect with people. This is how I'm going to meet new people. This is how I'm going to start reading. That's a possibility too, don't you think, Lee?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm a big believer in, you know, cross-pollination is how I think of it, you know. So when I come to a place, you know, because I'm a writer, I'm very curious about it. I want to know about the insects or the birds or, you know, how the clouds look, what the weather is like. And all of that ends up, you know, becoming a part of my my writing. And then that's something that, you know, can be shared with other people who've experienced those phenomenon, you know, and we can sort of think about, yes, I've seen that, or that makes sense to me as something I've physically experienced. At the same time, too, you know, when we get to this idea of permission once again, when you bring something else that's different and then you kind of cross-pollinate it, those experiences then can be shared, which I think makes for, you know, a richer literary texture in the state.
We want to get to some readings from some newest collections that you have, so we're going to take a break, and we'll come back and we'll hear more from Leanne Rohrpaw and Christine Stewart. Stay with us on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's Monday in summer, and we have a new program called the Brown Bag Book Club every Monday at noon throughout the summer. Join us for some of the top regional authors. You can join us in our studio audience at the SDPB Sioux Falls studio during the week of July 8th. We take the Brown Bag Book Club to Rapid City, and we'll have daily visits with authors there in the SDPB Rapid City studio. Also, you can join us in the studios there during that week. Today, my guests are Leanne Rohrpaw and Christine Stewart. Leanne has been the South Dakota State Poet Laureate for 4 years. On July 1st, she passes that baton to Governor Noem's new appointee, Christine Stewart. And for this next period of time, we're going to look at some of your work and hopefully press you to do some reading for us. And Leanne, let's start with you and this latest collection, Tsunami versus the Fukushima 50. Stunning book, first of all. So thank you so much for it. And I feel like people need to understand the big picture of this and where, you know, tell us a little bit about the idea and how you started working on this particular book.
Well, I was very haunted by the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami, which in itself was devastatingly destructive, but then led to the subsequent Fukushima Daiichi reactor meltdown. And it just seemed like such an awful thing to happen to, you know, a country who'd already had, you know, terrible experiences with radiation following the dropping of the atomic bombs at the end of World War II. I was just really struck by that. And I decided that I wanted to find a way to write about it, to, you know, commemorate and honor the experience and the victims, because of something that disappeared really so quickly from the news cycle, yet it is still ongoing, because it's 2019 now, and only now this year have people who have become part of the nuclear diaspora been slowly allowed to return to some of their homes in the no-go zone. And of course there are questions about, you know, the cleanup, the level of contamination. There have been increased cases of thyroid cancer in children. So, you know, there's an environmental or eco-critical legacy that's ongoing as well. And so I wanted to focus attention on that. What I decided to do was I was inspired by the Godzilla movies and comics, which were very much an environmental response to the dropping of the atomic bomb. So there were mutant monsters rising on Monster Island in Japan. So that was one inspiration. And then I was also inspired by superheroes from comic books who frequently gain their superpowers through accidents involving radioactivity. So those became some of the tropes that I threaded in. I created a supervillainess named Tsunami, who was created by the trauma of the fault line in the ocean floor, very much like the way that X-Men's Magneto was created through the trauma of the Holocaust. And so it allowed me to explore gender, female rage, environmental questions, as well as honor, you know, the survivors and the deceased from the disaster.
And you must have known fairly early on what you had your arms around, that you're going to have to spend a lot of time with these people, with these voices, yeah. with this topic. How do you sort of care for yourself in a way, separate yourself, but yet enter the space so you can really have the full empathy that you need, but yet not be damaged in some way, not to compare your damage to mm-hmm. what those people are going through and have gone mm-hmm. through, but it's a real question, don't you think?
It is intense. I mean, I think that writing or poetry in particular is an act of, you know, radical empathy or compassion. And when you immerse yourself in some of these events, there's an intensity, an emotional intensity to that. But I think there's a poem by Kathy Song, who grew up in Hawaii, who talked about hearing a widower play the shakuhachi flute at night, and then he would cry she could hear him crying in the house next door through the open windows for his dead wife. And then the closing line of it, that she was like a shell on the beach that had like been washed clean but was still safe. And so the intensity of the ocean kind of sweeping over the shell, but there was also a kind of catharsis or safety to being able to experience it in the remove. Hmm.
Will you read from us, from this book for us? I've picked out a few poems that I'm hoping we might start with.
Sure.
And the first one, if you're following along at home, is on page 8. And I'll let you set it up and introduce.
Okay. This is called Animal Portents Foretell the Rise of Tsunami. And so if there is a supervillainess headed your way, perhaps there should be portents to herald her arrival. And these are all, interestingly, things that animals do biologically when disaster or extreme weather, like earthquakes or tornadoes, are coming. So these are all actual signs that you can read in the natural world. There is a snippet in Japanese, and that's an homage to a woman named Miki Endo, who worked at the disaster prevention office in Minami-Soma. And she stayed on the loudspeaker and told people to seek higher ground and run away. And many people said that they hadn't gone to a high enough ground, and that hearing her say that saved their lives. But she lost her life. She was the office was eventually swept away in the tsunami. Animal portents foretell the rise of tsunami. When elephants kneel, pressing their trunks down to the ground like seismic antenna. When mole rats head drum adumbrations, listen for predictions, auger jawbones snugged to tunnel walls. When cats spill from windows, slip through open doors, some welder's torch sizzle fizzing the tips of their whiskers. When insect swarms clot the shore in a frantic, tangled macrame, and hippopotamuses bellow a chorus of mournful cellos. When snakes awaken from hibernation, curlicuing up from their dens like bolts come unscrewed, their frozen bodies a semiology of hieroglyphs in the snow. Takadai ni tatsu, takadai ni tatsu, Takedai ni tatsu, hayaku nigeru. When double helixes spun by skeins of flying sparrows unravel, when centipedes appear in rippling synchronicities, when colonies of toads erupt like burst popcorn from pond's silver foil, when fish come unschooled, when bees abandon their queens, flee their honey, when silky clusters of bats lift in smoky volcanic furies as if rising from a city ravished in flame.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment. My guests are Leanne Rorpaugh and Christine Stewart. You've been listening to Leanne Rorpaugh read from Tsunami versus the Fukushima 50. And I'm hoping we can just jump to the next page, and if you would read Radioactive Man for us.
Radioactive Man is based on, most of my dramatic monologues are in the voices of fictional characters, but this is one of the characters that is close to real life. There were two men who stayed behind in the no-go zone despite the radioactivity to care for the animals, and this is one of them. So his comic book alter ego is Radioactive Man. The papers started calling me Radioactive Man after tests from the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency revealed the highest radiation levels in anyone they'd ever screened. I guess I'm the champion, I joke, to reporters who come for interviews like visitors from another planet. Bulky and brightly awkward in white hazmat suits, they look like mourners at a Buddhist funeral. And so I light a cigarette to dangle from the corner of my lip and grin. Even 8 miles away in Tomioka, the sound of reactor 4 exploding was completely unmistakable. So I took my elderly parents south to my aunt in Iwaki, who refused to even open her door to us because she said we were contaminated. Then we tried a temporary shelter, but it was full, so we came home again to the no-go zone, and when other relatives agreed to take in my parents, I stayed behind to care for the abandoned animals. I've seen many terrible things, cages filled with withered songbirds, horses left to starve in their stalls, an abandoned puppy that grew too big for the chain around its neck. I rescue as many as I can. The dog trapped inside a barn for months, who survived by eating the dead flesh of starved cattle. Or the feral ostrich, so vicious the police who border patrol the nuclear exclusion zone, armed with Geiger counters, nicknamed her the boss. All over Tomioka, the animals recognize the sound of my truck and come running to meet me when I make my daily rounds. Many come to stay with me at my family's old rice farm, living without water or electricity in the ruins of the town where I was born is sometimes very lonely. I wait for cancer or leukemia, and joke to the boss about becoming a superhero through a radioactive ostrich bite. Sometimes I think of visiting my two kids who live with my ex-wife in Tokyo, but then I remind myself of the invisible dust coated in cesium particles that's in my clothes, my hair, my skin. I remember I can see my future in the sick animals I care for. In the American Watchmen comics, Dr. Manhattan was once tricked into believing he'd given everyone he ever loved cancer through exposure to his radioactive body. Just the thought of this undid him, made him feel so solitary and blue, he left the earth behind for eons to brood in exile on the moon.
Thank you. Christine Stewart, we have two books that we're hoping to press you to read from today, Blue Words Greening and Untrust. And I'd like to start with Blue Words Greening, because you alluded to this earlier in some of the themes that ended up in this particular collection. Hoping you would read Boy at Rest. Do you want to set that up for us at all?
Sure. It is an ekphrastic piece, meaning it was inspired in part by a piece of art, Girl at Rest. And it's also based on my son's epilepsy syndrome, which is called Landau-Kleffner syndrome. And this form of epilepsy acted like a tamper on his ability to learn for many years, and it also regressed his ability to use language and understand language. So you get a description of that in this poem. Boy at Rest, with an epigraph from Caroline Forché's The Angel of History. While sleeping, the child vanishes from his life. In Girl at Rest, I saw only a hazy silhouette of a child's body, the navy blue flame of her arms, head, and a bit of torso. And I read the artist's choice of ochre and light gray, shades shifting only slightly, to convey background and skin with wonder. The colors nearly vanish the child. When I study my son asleep, it's in full dimension, eyelids threaded with a blue vein, a freckle emerging on the outline of his lip. There's no facial stress, but I don't need to guess. Rest is an illusion, not a feature of a brain besought by seizures. By day, they complicate the spelling of C-A-T, blur the way sounds rolling into each other infuse meaning. When sound does get through the screen of spells, a word may fail to find its place on his tongue. The seizures also erase memories of lunchtime pizza, gym class tag, the answer to what's your last name, the need to look both ways before crossing the parking lot outside the store. On the monitor, I hear him speak, a midnight phrase thrown from deep sleep, and I wonder what sounds emerge, despite the seizures' surge, from the visual play of his dreams. What world does he vanish to? It seems impossible to draw in ink or words more than a sleeping child's curves and angles. When I tiptoe into his room to retuck his blanket, I'll only assume that wherever he's at, he'll come back.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. That was Christine Stewart reading from Blue Words Greening. And before we take a break, would you read one more from this book? I'm looking at Plans.
This is one I don't often read. I think this is part two of the book. So the first part is based on my son's epilepsy syndrome and the language issues that I experience as I learn about them. The second half of this book is based on something equally mysterious and unknowing as an epilepsy syndrome, which is my experience with recurrent miscarriage. And so there's that in this poem. So, Plans. At age 3, I heard my mom's lessons for Sunday school, coloring Jesus, one idea. Come Sunday, time ran out. Later, Mom said, but it was on the plan, I cried. When I learned to write, I printed daily menus. On puppy stationery, I scheduled hours of leisure, read, write to pen pals, walk dog, play with baby brother. In high school, I plotted dreams, college, marriage, house with garden, career, kids. Check, 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 except the last letter of the last one. Last winter, I graphed my garden in detail. Stenciled circles intersected, parallel lines perfect along blue cells. In summer, zucchini produced 20 long green limbs before too much rain caused root rot. Acorn squash gave 2 apple-sized specimens before it succumbed. I thought of them that September at my last DNC, 4th miscarriage, when the doctor scraped to hollow out, to leave empty and tender. How perfect plans look on paper, sketched in colored pencil, penned on glossy calendars. And still, I yearn to color Jesus, perhaps in the parable of the loaves and fishes, where he saw hunger and he saw need, and although it wasn't part of the plan, Jesus created something from nothing. No, something from love.
We will have more with the poets after the break. Thank you so much for that. You're in listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. My guests this hour are Leanne Rorapaw and Christine Stewart. Leanne is the outgoing state poet laureate, the current poet laureate until July 1st, and then she passes the baton to Christine Stewart. And will you both be at the book festival in September?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of the process here? All right. And we're asking them to read some from their book and various books. And we're going to stick with Christine for a minute because we need to get to Wonder Woman. I have a Wonder Woman relaxes on my list of things I'm hoping that you would read for us. Your fascination with Wonder Woman, you're playing with her as an archetype and a character. Explain that a little bit before you read, please.
Yeah, I think similar to Lee, I reach to stories and icons to work ideas and emotions mm-hmm. through. And at all my books, there's one. And this book, I turned to Wonder Woman because I had grown up watching the TV series. And so I took a lot of liberties with there's the TV series, there's the movie, there's the comic. So, you know, strict aficionados can argue with me about it. But I kind of liberally used that icon in this poem and in the other poems in the book related to her, related to this one. So I like to imagine what she was doing when we didn't see her in those moments. Wonder Woman relaxes. Closing her steno pad at 5, Diana contemplates cuisine. Not the break room's lime jello. Superfood. Spinach sautéed in olive oil. Quinoa pilaf with Turkish apricots. Once home, glasses off, hair ponytailed, sweatpants on, she slices a pineapple like it's cream cheese. As she julienne's jalapenos, she needs no magic bracelet. Golden lassos won't quicken the task. She admires the cut's discernment. When her man's in trouble, Wonder Woman busts him out, slaps, slugs, strikes. What does it matter if she breaks a nail or three? Her man doesn't see her. Post-mission, he's safe watching TV, and Diana's free to pummel villains with Superman, Aquaman. They love her feminine touch. Tonight, comics will wait. Skimming across the dusty wine rack, she chooses a cab, Opus 1, 85, and pulls out the company, creme brulee. On the balcony, she dines, the city's honks and calls her symphony. Sirens pulse through her veins like a heartbeat.
Christine Stewart reading from her collection, Untrust. And Lee, I'm sure you'd have a lot, if we just stop talking, let you two talk about sort of this. I'm hoping that we can go back to Hungry Tsunami as a poem. And if you could say a little something about that sort of female embodiment of Tsunami.
So one of the things that I wanted Tsunami to be was very fluid, shape-shifting, mercurial, sometimes noble, sometimes scary. So let's see. I'll find the page. Okay. So Hungry Tsunami is about appetite, because one of the things I imagine that she would just be very hungry, you know, wanting to like consume, that kind of unstoppable force or the force of nature. And all of the tsunami poems are all in third person as opposed to the survivors or victims of the Fukushima disaster. Those are first person monologues. But I felt that if she's a force of nature, these would all be third person projections direction. So in some ways, she's a mirror for things that we want to personify about her, or our fears, or also our desires and hungers even. So this one is all about hunger. And this, the subtitle is Tsunami is Galactus. And Galactus was a supervillain who would consume entire planets. He would like scout out planets with heralds, and then he would just kind of suck them dry. So this is then about her hunger. Hungry Tsunami, or Tsunami as Galactus. The hunger of trying to hold back the hunger a little bit longer. The hunger of restraint and pullback, churn and growl of beached fishes in an agitated bouillabaisse, liquid silver squirming on an empty shore. To lick the gilding from the buildings like golden drizzles of caramel. To take the cake, flick off the crumbs. To raise the fruit, spit out the pits. The hunger of sucked out marrow, the unwillingly pried open oyster, the cracked and pillaged lobster claw. To shuck, to husk, to unshell her way to what's most tender. To dismantle the protective scrims that signal a cache of rawness. To demolish defenseless succulents. The hunger for the liquid center, squirt of ganache in a Swiss truffle, chocolate lava cake's molten fondant core. To feed past the end of greed. To feast past the end of want. To gorge past the borders of voraciousness until she becomes the monstrous goddess of binge, pure mercenary lack. The blooded face, blood in the water, the blood moon's exposed sweet throat with its lipsticked jugular bitten clean out.
Thank you for that. One of the great parts of this is watching or listening to you sort of hear each other's poems and and then respond to those lines and those. What are you listening for when you're listening to someone else read, Christine?
Well, I haven't read her book, new book yet, because she was supposed to come read up at SDSU in April, and I was saving all of it for that, and we had to cancel. So right now I'm just kind of hearing all this sound and the images as they come one at a time, and then I always anticipate the end because she's always really just like a door slamming at the end of the poem, and I feel like I'm a good listener if I know, if my heartbeat starts to race a little bit more when I'm anticipating that door slamming. Yeah, I think that's what I'm doing when I'm listening.
Yeah. And how is it different when you're reading versus when you're listening? If you were just reading, I mean, are you hearing the voice too? Because one of the things that when I was reading this is sometimes I had a hard time finishing a poem just because I kept going back and like and trying to, oh, how did she find that word? I mean, I was in marvel. And so in some ways, I got a little dazzled by, you know, just the structure of what you were doing. That I had to just say, okay, just enjoy the poem as its whole, and then go back and do this. Is it different for you when you read the words on the page versus when you hear the poet's voice?
Yeah, you summarized what I do too.
All right, let's have another one from Christine, please. How about, in the interest of time, Bodhisattva of the Kitchen Sink?
Oh, okay.
Because I love this one, and I don't want to run out of time and not hear it.
So this poem kind of goes after that love poem, right, of the plans, like what does love mean? And I think this book tries to figure that out. And so this is one of the last poems in the book. Bodhisattva of the Kitchen Sink. In the brightening kitchen, she pulls a dull-haired mop like a child pressing a pencil top across gray-lined paper, and she picks off a cushion's lint like a robin worming for breakfast. In arcs, she scours shower stalls as a carpenter sands off stain. What bliss plays on her lips when her feather duster tickles a desk, when her rag caresses grandma's pink depression glass, a cake plate, until it shines. Oh, enlightened one, what lovers of fresh scents do to woo you. Sweep floors, dry dishes, defrost refrigerators, polish chandeliers. We invent vacuums and self-cleaning ovens. Someone even washed clothes, ironed shirts, and folded brassieres. We ignore the labor of elbow grease that birthed you and forget how long the teasing of dust bunnies from under beds demonstrates your devotion. Love's in the press of palm to polished trim, in a wrist's quick swipe of toast crumbs, in circles that free mirrors of streaks, in scratches that unstick grit from textured walls. Goddess of all things sparkling, your pure heart pumps bleach. Inspired my simple gestures, bestow a kiss of cleanliness on me.
Reading from the book Untrust. One of the roles as a poet laureate has to, or at least how people see you, I think, I don't know if it's how you see yourselves, but people want to connect and become better writers themselves. So let's talk about that just for a minute. Did you find that as you went around, Leanne, that people were asking not just how to connect with poetry, but to how to be a better poet? How do I make the next step in my own journey?
Absolutely, because I think, you know, sometimes the most voracious and committed readers are also people who are interested in writing themselves. So, yeah, there's always writers in the audience, which is great.
So it seems like the advice is read, write.
Yeah.
Is it more complicated than that?
It can be, but I think in a very basic way. I think reading, one of the things I really like to suggest, though, is to read voraciously, but also as widely as possible, so that, you know, you discover, if you want to write poetry, you discover the kind of poetry that you really like, you know, which in some ways is reflection of the kind of poet you might like to be. But then beyond that, to read poets that you may not instinctively or immediately connect with. I call it sort of reading across the grain as a way of maybe complicating your understanding of what a poem is or what a poem can be, and letting those kinds of additional influences enter the spectrum.
And I would add to that, to read as a writer, mm-hmm. right? To, yeah. Like you were explaining, you stopped and said, I marvel at a word, how did she choose that? You're reading as a writer in some ways because you're starting to wonder how she makes those moves.
Right, and she never gives up on a word. That's my assessment of Leanne Burr. Like, she didn't just stop at two good words. Like, she kept going until she got to this. And you can see the fingerprint of that. Mm-hmm. Leanne Rohrpaugh and Christine Stewart, thank you so much for being here with us today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.